Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about nuclear science. We all know that the atom is comprised of a nucleus, and then there's all those funny electrons that are going around. But what's really the structure? What are the utilities? What are the interesting things about the nucleus? Nuclear power, nuclear weapons, all sorts of things. And today, the expert that's going to be talking to us about the whole concept of nuclear science is Heino Nitsche. He's from the University of California in Berkeley. And Heino, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited being here.
Wow.
And it is a great honor. And I heard the people that you have interviewed before, and so I consider myself very lucky to
We're enchanted that you're here. And we want to find out a little bit about Heino, though. Before we get on to the whole business of the nucleus and nuclear science, what about you? How did you become a scientist? What's your background?
My background, as you hear from my accent, from my Schwarzenegger-like accent, not that I identify myself with him, is that I'm born in Germany. I'm born in Munich, and I grew up in Munich. And the interesting thing, you asked me about science and my background and how I got to it, is I went to they call the high school in Germany gymnasium. I went to the gymnasium called Luitpold Gymnasium. And many years later, I found out that a very famous person went to this gymnasium, but there was no plaque or anything. And that person is Einstein. Albert Einstein, he went to the same gymnasium, and I had to find this out. Many, many, many years later, I read an article that he actually was expelled from that school because he was completely unmanageable. And as you know, probably Einstein, he had a learning disability and he couldn't really read very well until he was 9.
He was dyslexic, is that
dyslexic,
right?
Dyslexic, yeah. And so he went into this boys' gymnasium. And so he had terrible grades, and he wasn't paying attention because he understood everything. And so then I think he was 14 or 15. The principal called the mother in, and the mother said, you know, we need to take him off the school. And she said, I don't know what to do with that boy. I really have no idea what to do with him. He said, don't worry, ma'am. Nothing will become of him anyway. That's what the principal said. And that's when he went to Switzerland to his uncle, and then he had this comet-like career.
And
with 21, he had discovered the photoelectric effect. And
Were you ever expelled from school?
No, I wasn't. So I was very lucky in this term that I had a teacher who was a sports teacher and our chemistry teacher. He went very far afterwards, after he was very young. And so I very much looked up to him, and I did not want to disappoint him, so I had the best grades there always. If I would have had probably a historian as a teacher like this, I probably would have gone into history, studied history. So this is how I came into chemistry, and he inspired me. So that what shows to me is that it's very important that you have people who are lead you when you're in your formative years, and the early high school years are very, very important for science, and that's where we miss out.
Well, what about your parents? Were they just let you go anyway, or did they get into discussions with the school teachers?
They did, but I was on my own. I had discussions at home with my father. He was an engineer, an electronics engineer, and my mother was a homemaker, and I had the advantage that my brother was 8 years older, and there was a war in between, and so I was born after the war. So they didn't have the eye so much on the ball, namely me at this time, and so I was very lucky.
So where did you study? Do you study in Munich?
No, I went to the Free University in Berlin, in West Berlin. It was a very interesting experience, and I got my both degrees there. And you probably asked me about the reasons why I went to Berlin. And one of the reasons was that the military already had drafted me. And then they found out that from my year, I'm born in 1949, they had too many people. They couldn't accommodate all the people they had drafted. And so then they came up, if you want to go into science and you can prove that you only can start this in the spring semester, then you will be...
Avoid the draft.
And first I went to Erlangen and then I went to Berlin. So, but I did not dodge the draft.
Of course not.
Yeah, so.
No one dodges. They all avoid. The word is to avoid. Okay.
Yes.
Dodge is just is a bit, it's not a good word. Anyway, so you're a nuclear scientist. Let's sort of get into that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how did you choose to do nuclear science? I did it for a year for a master's degree, and I found it rather tedious. So I moved to something more gratifying quickly.
This was in the early 70s. There was this trend to going towards nuclear energy, and I thought this was a real future. And then I had a very interesting professor at the Free University of Berlin, and I fell in love with it, and I found this rather fascinating. And so I did my first degree. It was in electrochemistry and nuclear chemistry, and then I got my PhD in Berlin, and from then it's history.
What's your real passion about the nucleus and nuclear science?
I have many different interests in nuclear chemistry. I'm an actinite chemist, so I deal with actinites, with neptunium,
plutonium, yeah, things of that nature, right.
And I started my career exploring the thermodynamics, solution thermodynamics of actinides, related to fundamental processes in the environment, for example, nuclear waste disposal. What happens if the worst case of water breaks into a nuclear waste disposal, nuclear waste site, high-level waste site? What are the processes that can happen with the waste itself? And this boils down to solubility and speciation, and then it relates to transport, and only, first of all, it all this has to be
so
soluble.
I mean, this is led, I mean, you're an environmental scientist on the one hand, and you got to know about hydrology. I mean, so it's a pretty interdisciplinary activity.
Yeah, I don't know much about hydrology, but it is an interdisciplinary activity, which nearly every science is nowadays. You
yes.
have to look above the across the border of to the other disciplines, and this will give you more than the sum of the individual yeah. disciplines. And so environmental transport is a multidisciplinary endeavor. In order to understand this, you need to talk to quite a few people, and this is where the future lies, where the big discoveries can be made in our field by having interdisciplinary understanding.
Tell us a little bit about your position on nuclear energy. I know, I mean, coming from Germany, the Germans have been somewhat reticent as a nation to engage in new nuclear power stations, the same as in North America, although the Obama administration seems to be moving much more to build new power stations. Whereas the French, your neighbors over there in Europe, they seem to love their nuclear power, 70% to 80% of their electricity.
It's 80% actually.
Yeah, so yeah. What's the difference? Well, I mean, these two nations, cheek by jowl, as they say, totally different attitudes.
Okay, first of all, I decided to leave Germany many years ago, okay?
Okay, so you're not responsible for anything that happens there.
I'm an American citizen. Also, I'm a citizen of Germany, though. That's just my roots, and I don't forget my roots. The point there is you were asking me, why is there such a difference between the countries? There's much political positioning, and there's this tremendous fear of nuclear, which is also in this country. The French, however, they have a very different approach. And when we had the first oil crisis in 1973, the French immediately said, we are not going to be dependent on oil that much. Of course, we need oil, and we have uranium, and we're going to develop nuclear power. And so they went full throttle on this, and they are now 80% nuclear. The population is generally against any risk. So we would like to have a risk-free society. And if you look in the press, we are striving for a risk-free society. We take tremendous risks. Just for example, this morning, as we drove here, it's a very big risk that we could get injured.
Are you yeah? criticizing my driving?
No, I'm not. This is statistically proven, actually. That's science. And so we have this obsession with the risk-free society. And, of course, everything has risks. And so it does nuclear, and the risk is, of course, being perceived as much higher. And the reason is the following, that the nuclear age started not peacefully. It started with a bomb. And the general population has always this mushroom cloud in the back of their mind. If they go by a nuclear reactor or drive by a nuclear reactor, they have this picture, if this thing goes off, there will be this mushroom cloud and we all will be vanishing, which is not the case, as accidents have shown. So this has been used politically very much. Coming back to America, is we had in California, you're probably aware that this company Enron, they dealt with the Californians in a very mean way in the early 2000s. They gave us not enough energy, so suddenly the air conditioners in the Central Valley of California couldn't work. It came to the height of this in San Francisco when all the traffic lights were not working at 5 o'clock during rush hour. So people usually take about an hour to drive home. They suddenly took 3 hours to drive home. And before, the population there was about 29% pro-nuclear. After that, it was 61%. I don't know what it is now, but it takes serious impacts in order to right. sway the population and the public opinion. We are not aware what the consequences of not having energy readily available are. We don't have in this country an energy policy. We've never been told what are the consequences if we don't do that, if we don't get enough energy. So if we never know what the consequences are, we will never make a decision.
But going back then to, you know, the apart from the mushroom cloud, the other big bogeyman is, you know, where do you store, quote-unquote, the famous nuclear waste? How do you protect it from nasty people wanting to do terrorist activities? What do they do in France? I mean, how do they handle the nuclear waste in France?
They protect it at the nuclear power plants at the moment. They do reprocessing. They reprocess also for other countries.
Tell us what reprocessing means.
So if you have a fuel element, the fuel element is made from uranium, and uranium has a very small part. There's different kind of isotopes of uranium. There's uranium-238, which is 99.3% of natural uranium. But you have this 0.7% of uranium-235. And if you put neutrons into uranium-235, you fission it, you release energy, you make two new nuclei, and by doing so, when they are reforming, they release energy, and they produce more neutrons. And they produce more than one neutron. They produce, in fact, an average 2.5. And these 2.5 can react again and again and again. So if you don't control this, then you have a bomb. So you need to sequester these neutrons to have a constant neutron flux. That's how you can
get electricity.
You heat water, essentially. You make steam, and you put the steam on the turbine, and then you make electricity the normal way. And so this uranium is 1 ton of fuel, for example, produces about 34 kilos of fission products. So what are fission products? So this is when the nucleus explodes, you have these two other nuclei, and they are called fission products. Now, they are highly reactive, they are highly radioactive, and they decay, many, many beta decays to get cooler and cooler.
And a beta decay, for those out there, it's an electron coming out of the nucleus.
Exactly, exactly.
And it doesn't travel very far.
No. Right? But they are very hot because they keep doing this.
Yes.
But their half-lives are rather short. So they have strontium or cesium has a half-life of about 30 years. And by a rule of thumb, you can say after 10 half-lives, you have 1 in 1,000 left. Right. So it's actually gone all.
Yeah, that's so 300 years.
Exactly.
I mean, although we think that's short, it is a long time. And that's a nice point to interject. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Heino Nietzsche from the University of California. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Of all the bacteria in and on our bodies that we need for good health, there's one that may determine whether some people are obese.
The bacterium called Akkermansia mucinophila is in a layer of the mucus that coats the surface of the lining of the intestinal tract. In a healthy person, this bacterium comprises 3 to 5% of all bacteria present, which is a lot.
A recent study found the amount of this bacteria in your intestinal tract is highly correlated with your body weight. That means low numbers of it are correlated with obesity and type 2 diabetes, and high numbers are linked to a healthy weight.
Researchers made this discovery using a mouse study. Mice fed a high-fat diet became obese and had 100 times lower levels of Akkermansia than mice fed the normal diet.
The next part of the experiment sealed the deal. When the obese mice on a high-fat diet were fed this bacterium, they lost weight and began showing lower insulin resistance, suggesting they were no longer pre-diabetic.
The mucus layer in the intestinal tract also began to thicken, which increased the levels of endocannabinoids. These chemicals are a family of small molecules in the gut that control inflammation and the integrity of the gut barrier. They also positively regulate glucose homeostasis, which again can influence whether a person gets diabetes.
I can just imagine a yogurt company one day adding this bacteria to the family of probiotics already in yogurt today.
If that can help me fight the bulge, I'm in.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Heino Nietzsche, and we're talking about nuclear explosions, but you slow down that process. You sequester the neutrons, you get a controlled process. But at the end, you're going to have the nuclear material that you use is going to be used up. It's just not going to be efficient. Now you've got to take that rod or whatever it is, and you've got to do something with it and all the fission products. What do the French do with those fission products?
What the French do, they reprocess it. So actually there's lots of good energy still left in there.
Right.
But these fission products that are created in that process and the activation products or neutron capture products like plutonium, which is made, and neptunium and americium and curium, these are higher actinides, higher than uranium in nuclear number. They are slowing down this process. So after a certain burn-up, you have to take out that fuel element, and then you can do two things with it. One is you don't do nothing and let it just sit at the nuclear power plant, but since plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, you would have to let it sit for 240,000 years to get it down to 1 in 1,000, to 1 per mil, and this is not really an option. So, you let it sit for a certain time to let the short-lived ones decay, then it's easier to handle. And now you have two options. One option is to store it safely, just the fuel rod as it is, unprocessed. This is the option that we had at the moment in the United States. This was under Jimmy Carter. He said there will be no reprocessing in 1978. And then you put it in an underground geological repository and you guard it and you dispose of it. And, of course, you have to guarantee now, at least for a couple of 100,000 years, that this is safe. I think it's pretty, I wouldn't say arrogant, but bold to say that we can predict what will happen in the next 100,000 years. If you look, for example,
the records say that all these people, they put a new building up, 80 years ago, and they put a time capsule, and now they don't know where it is. Right?
Yes,
this is 80 years, and it was well documented where it was. So what's the alternative to the story?
The alternative is that you chemically process this. You separate. You separate the short-lived radionuclides, they call it the fission product, and you separate the long-lived ones, and you dispose them differently. The short-lived, you don't need to guarantee that long. And the long-lived, you can also transmute them. You can actually use them as fuel. Plutonium is a fuel. If you have a different kind of reactor, a plutonium reactor, then you can use it as fuel. And by doing so, you can use some of the neutrons that you gain in the reactor, and they transmute the higher ones than plutonium, and they make them to transmute them to other nuclides that are shorter lived. That's essentially one of the strategies. So you do separation. You take out the fuel that you can use. You take out the new fuel that you made, plutonium, and you burn it again. So there's so much valuable energy left in a spent fuel rod that one should not
be burying it in the ground.
The concept of burying is that people in a couple of thousand years, they will dig for this and say, this is a great idea they had to leave this for us that we have in a thousand years. The people
source
said, we have a new source of energy. Right. You have a plutonium mine, so to speak.
There's one in Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Yes.
There was going to be one in Nevada, but I guess the yucca.
This has been that's the first step. They killed that.
Okay. Going back to the French then, they recycle a lot. So, in fact, they've got a continuous loop.
They don't quite have a continuous loop yet because that's the goal. The plutonium reactors are not there yet. They do have some plutonium.
What are the issues? Why are plutonium reactors not available yet?
It's also cost at this point. Still, uranium is cheaper at the moment, and the cost plays a big role in every energy issue that we have.
And there's a limited amount of uranium in the world, too.
Yeah, it's going to last for quite a while.
Give me
at least 100 years.
At least 100 years, right? Well, that's very encouraging. And so the plutonium that we kept from those, how long is that going to last?
That we can make this.
We
have time.
So another couple hundred years.
Easily.
Yeah, so we've got to find an alternative to nuclear power, though, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We should still be looking at solar energy, wind power, all the other bits and pieces.
I cannot agree more with you.
Yeah.
There's also good science coming out of this, and this will help other fields. For example, if you live here, you have lots of sunshine and you have lots of heat and you need air conditioning. Yeah. I think every house should have a solar panel to run the air conditioning from it. It should be self-sufficient.
Yeah.
And this is a policy you need to achieve. I mean, there's no need for anybody with the air conditioner in a southern climate to go on the net, on the electrical grid. Yeah. And these are things we need to think about.
And especially here, I mean, you probably know that we have what they call swamp coolers. So this is just, we trickle water over pads and then suck in the dry air. And then the moisture going into the air cools down the air.
Yes.
And so we need only a little motor going around it.
Yes.
We don't, a lot of people do have real air conditioning, but most people have these very efficient swamp cooling.
Oh, this is very interesting. Oh, I did not know that because I had a friend who lived in Egypt. And what they did, they were in the living room, they were hanging up wet sheets to cool down.
Yeah, and then a fan blowing.
Yeah, they didn't even have a fan, they just hung up these wet sheets. Yeah. I didn't know that this is a
that's all over this part of North America.
It's very interesting. Cool.
I mean, in August it can get, you know, a little tedious sometimes. On a few days you get the summer monsoons and it gets too humid so that the water doesn't evaporate, so it's just not so efficient.
Yeah,
but
for
most of the time when we need air conditioning, that's what we have.
In summary, I mean, we are a nation who has the highest energy use of all nations in the world.
Yeah.
And there is definitely many, many areas where we can save energy. That's where we should start.
Yeah.
And we should educate this in the schools and from the, in the kindergarten to save energy. And
yeah,
it should become not a religion, but it should become second nature.
My youngest son is always going around turning off the lights.
Yes.
And he always wants to turn the computer off and not on standby. That's an issue because, you know, I'll come in and I think I left it on standby and I got to reboot the whole thing.
Yes, yes. So it will be faster. Very soon we have no hard disk anymore, just in memory, so it's no big deal anymore.
Let's change subjects. Let's go on to an area that I know you're very active on, and that's what I might call single atom chemistry. What's this expression for 10 to the minus 23 or whatever?
No, people say they do nanoscience, it's 10 to the minus 9.
Right.
And we are doing septoscience, this is 10 to the minus 21. We use maybe between 1 and 100 atoms. So if you have a septomole, that is a mole is 6 times 10 to the 23rd times 10 to the 21, so it's about 600
atoms
you have.
Now, how do you study 600 atoms?
Oh, that's a tremendous 600 atoms.
Okay, so go down to the lowest limit.
Yeah, we study actually one at a time.
You've studied one atom.
And the interesting thing is that what makes it statistically significant, we do chemistry with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just chemistry, very fast chemistry, either gas phase chemistry, thermochromatography, and at the end we detect our product. And it only could have gotten to our detector if it went through this chemical process that we have designed.
So give me an example.
A good example is hassium. Hassium is element number 108.
How do you spell it?
H-A-S-S-I-U-M.
Hassium.
Hassium.
Okay.
The symbol is HS.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a state in Germany, Hessia. Yeah. Hessia. And this is sort of, they did the same thing like we in California.
Californium.
Californium.
Right.
So it's called hassium. And the group above, you study the chemistry of the homologues. And the homologue above is osmium. And osmium forms tetroxides. And you study first the chemistry, devise a chemistry, a single atom chemistry with osmium. So you study osmium tetroxide. And then you use that chemistry for your unknown chemistry. And you can pray and hope that it behaves like the homologue. If it behaves like the homologue, then first of all you see that there is actually, it belongs to that same group in the periodic system, which is fascinating.
So you have seen hessium tetroxide.
Hessium tetroxide.
Okay.
It was done in an international collaboration. We react this, we create this hessium, and then we react it with oxygen and the helium stream. We put this through an oven at 1,200 degrees to form it, and then we do it through a capillary where we do a thermochromatography. And at the end, actually, this capillary is cooled, and the capillary is made out of detectors which are facing each other. There's a very fine channel, and there is a temperature gradient on these detectors. And on one side, it's warm. On the other side, it's cold, very cold, liquid nitrogen cooled. And so somewhere, it will deposit on the detector because of the thermal gradient. And then it's on the detector, and then it starts decaying. It decays by a chain of alpha decays. And this makes it statistically significant because you know that it has to be hassium to have these daughter nucleides, which alpha,
right,
chain.
Right.
It goes 108 goes to 106. There's a seaborgium, 106 goes to 104, which is rutherfordium. And we know the half-lives and we know the energy of those.
Right.
And so with this, we can prove that it was hassium.
The experiment, how long does it take?
The experiment takes, the isotope is 4 seconds.
Yeah.
And, and the experiment takes a couple of seconds or less than that.
So you don't really have much time to go out to pray. I mean,
you don't have much time to pray. You pray before.
You pray before.
And the interesting thing is that because of the relativistic effect of the electrons, it behaves, what the theoreticians show us, it behaves like the group member.
Okay.
Without those relativistic effects, it would not have the same behavior. So this is absolutely not explainable to me. How could Mendeleev know that?
It's interesting. You just talk about seaborgium and rutherfordium, and these are the giants of the nuclear chemistry and physics and before. And you worked with Glenn Seaborg, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I worked
right.
very well with him. And he was a very busy man, but he always made time for you. And I remember I worked in the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. I came to the United States as a staff scientist in the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in 1980. And whenever I wanted to talk to him, he did his exercises, and he went up and down at 3 o'clock in the hallway of the building from the first to the fourth floor, up and down. Whenever you had something you wanted to talk to, you just go and walk with him in the hallway.
Right.
So every time I could talk to him, walk with him in the hallway. He was pleased to talk to me. And
he always looked, how would I put it, his face always looked quite cadaverous, I would have said.
He was a very thin person.
He was a very thin,
thin
fellow, right.
Person, yeah.
But I was on a couple of international American Chemical Society committees. He was the chair of the committee when I first joined. And you're absolutely right. I mean, he didn't know me, and he's no reason why he ever should. But he would always take time to talk and talk at the ACS meetings. He was a very interesting gentleman.
He was, and he came from a very modest background. And his parents, they came from Minnesota. They went to L.A. to the Watts area here, which is now not such a good area at the
right.
moment. And he went to high school there, and his father actually never found a permanent position anymore. He was a precision mechanic, and they sacrificed their living for the education of their son, which paid off quite well, actually.
And did the father ever get to see Glenn get the Nobel Prize?
I'm not aware of that. I haven't followed. Yeah. I know the story of Glenn very well, but not the relationship with his parents.
Okay. Hey, Heino, we've come to the end of our little discussion now, our unrehearsed journey into your life and the life of the nucleus. Thank you so much for being here. It's been great fun.
You're very welcome. It was great being here, and I look forward to talking more to you off the microphone.
Off the record. And we'd like to thank Norman Martinez, as usual, for putting this all together. And we thank you for being here and listening to the program. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Physicians and nurses across the El Paso region are urged to attend Biomed. It is a healthcare-focused symposium taking place in El Paso on October 26th. Biomed seeks to kickstart a culture of medical innovation in the region. Learn more and register at mcabiomed.com.